This is All Things Considered on KACU. I'm Heather Claiborne. Stan Lambert represents Taylor, Jones, and Nolan counties in the Texas State House. He's running for re-election to a third term after being targeted by the Speaker of the House, Dennis Bonin, also a Republican, for a challenge this election. We'll get to that later. The upcoming legislative session promises to be a busy one with a number of new issues to tackle brought about by the events of 2020. I'm talking today with State Representative Stan Lambert by Zoom. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Heather. It's good to be on the program, and I look forward to visiting with you about the issues that are confronting us today.
Well, let's start by talking about the state's handling of COVID-19. Do you think this situation has revealed any issues that state legislators need to address in the upcoming session?
Well, I certainly do. Obviously, I think the preparation and planning for handling a major pandemic for our state certainly raises questions about supply chains and inventory and accessibility to making sure that all our citizens, whether it's through hospitals or through the healthcare system, our schools, other first responders, those types of workers and employees need to be taken care of course. And so just questions about making sure that we have an adequate supply chain set up for future purposes, whether it's a hurricane or whether it's hopefully never again in my lifetime, another pandemic. Hopefully we can avoid some of those issues that occurred early in this process back in March and April. I think as we move forward into some of the middle months, I might say, or I'm not sure if they're middle months, but you might say some of the reopening months that Governor Abbott began reopening the Texas economy. I think there are questions that are lingering about just how much authority does one person, as the governor of the state, does he have access to and utilize as he has done, and that has made somewhat life difficult in many parts of our state. Things that might be happening in Houston don't necessarily apply to West Texas and vice versa. So I think the overall issue of just how much authority does a governor have, even in a disaster declaration status, without calling the legislature in for their involvement and getting their approval in certain ways of how we move forward. So I think there are things that the pandemic has revealed to us that we'll be addressing in the next session.
You supported Abilene's letter to Governor Abbott requesting more local control regarding the COVID-19 regulations. Are you saying that you think there are steps that the legislature can take, specific legislation that you could pass that he would then need to sign that would kind of rein in his free hand in this situation?
Well, I do. And I think that in many ways, I think he has tried to find where that fine line is between the safety and protection and the health and well-being of our 30 million residents in Texas, as well as trying to maintain some semblance of a normal economy moving forward, because we know that job losses and economic downturn has another type of health effect on the general welfare of our citizens. And so it's a fine line. And I do think the governor has done a fairly good job overall in terms of managing this. Where I would possibly have some reservations about continuing to allow him to have that much authority would be, again, related to the difference between what happens in some parts of our state don't necessarily happen in other parts of the state. And so if West Texas or if rural Texas has done a fairly good job of employing all of the suggestions and recommendations that have come down from CDC and the World Health Organization as far as using masks and certainly social distancing and cleaning our hands and not touching our face, those things have been done fairly well maybe in rural parts of the state, then We shouldn't be held to the same degree of standards that may be occurring in larger population areas like Harris County and Houston, where the numbers continue to rise and continue to be a problem as far as transmission. So again, this one-size-fits-all type approach sometimes by the state. I know the governor is again trying to find that fine line, but I do think that it needs to be looked at in various ways for some of our rural areas of the state differently than our urban populations. So that would be one area that I would certainly look forward to having an open dialogue and discussion with my colleagues, as well as the governor, to try to find out what he's comfortable with in terms of some of these changes and modifications. Obviously, he has the final say in any legislation that is passed. He has the right to veto. So we do want to work with him, and we want to work with his staff in finding solutions that make sense for a very large state that's continuing to grow and is very diverse in terms of where people are relocating and where they're moving to. And so it does encompass an all-around dialogue that does involve the governor and certainly lieutenant governor and whoever the new Speaker of the House will be.
Even before we knew how big of a problem COVID-19 would become for the economy, Governor Abbott had told state agencies to cut their budgets by 5%. How do you think the pandemic is going to affect the work that state agencies do? And what role do you see the State House taking in the upcoming session? It's my understanding that Texas has the largest rainy day fund in the nation. Is this the rainy day that we've been saving for?
I think it's certainly one of the tools that the legislature will certainly need to employ as part of covering part of the deficit that we're going to be incurring as part of the existing biennium, as well as the future biennium that we'll be approving a new budget in 2021. So I do think that, yes, the rainy day fund is certainly there for times like this. I think if we can't come to an agreement that it is raining, it's storming, we're in hurricane season as far as our healthcare systems, then yes, the rainy day fund is going to be one of those tools we need to employ. I do think that there are going to be other ways to try to address the budget deficiencies. Yes, the 5% was already in the works as far as looking ahead to our state agencies. You know, they've been through this before. 10 years ago in 2011, after the Great Recession that our country went through in 2008, 2009, and part of 2010, the state legislature 10 years ago had to make similar type cuts and reprioritize the funding priorities for our state going forward. So it's not like state agencies, like this would be something new to them. They've been through this before. Many times it's just a process of not filling a lot of open positions. People move in and out of these agencies on a regular basis, and so there always seems to be you're never at 100% employment in those agencies. So I do think that in some ways the 5%, although that's a large amount for some of these agencies like education and healthcare, that will be a fairly significant amount of dollars to save going forward. I do think that they've been through this before. They understand what it's going to require. Now, when we get to Austin in January, the comptroller will have a new revenue estimate for the next biennium. So all bets are off on exactly what that number is going to look like. I've heard rumors coming out of Austin. It could be as much as somewhere between 10 to 12 to maybe, as in the worst case scenario, maybe 15 billion. So we are looking at some major revenue shortfalls that are going to have to be dealt with in the next budget cycle. But I do think as we get this economy growing again, as we try to reopen Texas safely and responsibly, which I think we can and are continuing to do and showing signs now of a economic recovery, then I think that those things will come back into play as well as far as our growth, as far as the economic stability, as far as sales taxes increasing, as far as Texans getting back to work. Buying consumer goods, oil and gas activity obviously needs to increase as well. We're in a major downturn. which we're very familiar with here in West Texas because we're so close to the Permian Basin and Odessa and Midland, and we see firsthand what's happening there. So all of these things will come back in due time and hopefully sooner rather than later, but they'll all contribute at least to hopefully reducing the amount of what that deficit may look like over the next biennium.
What about education funding? Are you concerned that there's, you know, enough funding for what the schools and administrators need to continue providing the extra, you know, demands that this time has brought on?
Well, we made significant progress in the last session, as you may recall. We passed House Bill 3, which was a transformative, really a historical commitment on the part of the state of Texas for education funding, primarily in our public education sector. We added about $5.5 billion of new revenue, new funding for public schools. Most of that was directed towards the classroom, where teachers were the beneficiaries of some very instrumental and very significant increases in salary and compensation. Retirement benefits were added as well as part of that package. So I think we made such strong progress in the last session that I think it would be not just unwise, but it just doesn't, it wouldn't make good sense to me to come back and to make education the first place we go to try to find the additional revenue or the additional dollars we need to balance our budget. So I'm committed to making sure that we try to sustain those levels of funding that we added in the last session. It's going to be challenging, but it's going to be something that I think we can look at the rainy day fund. We can look at other ways, other tools that we have in the toolbox to try to address this overall budget deficit that we're going to face. But I think education has to be made the priority. We made such a strong commitment to it in the last session that we would just be negligent if we came back now and the next 2 years later and started making significant cuts. So I want to make sure that our children are protected, that our children have all the opportunities for success in the classroom, that our teachers have the resources and the tools they need to move forward. Yes, they've had added demands that have been placed on them, but I'm also hopeful that our federal government is recognizing what these added demands are in terms of COVID-19, and we'll step up to the plate and be responsible for the federal government's share of funding these additional demands that have been added to the classroom and to our teachers.
Well, COVID-19 has presented hospitals with a range of issues as well. Even as they're being stretched to their limits, a number of them are struggling financially, and rural hospitals specifically are facing closure in many areas. You've sponsored legislation to support efforts to provide healthcare in rural areas, and the governor even vetoed one of the bills, you know, last session that was aimed at protecting healthcare for rural communities. What is next in that particular issue?
Well, I think we just keep our foot on the accelerator to make sure that our rural hospitals don't suffer under the trend that was pre-COVID-19, and that was lack of census data, lack of occupancy, lack of number of physicians, number of registered nurses in some of our smaller communities around the state. We were just looking at some very unfavorable trends even before COVID-19. So yes, COVID-19 has added the additional pressure, but it's also opened up some doors to some opportunities that I think that we had already begun working towards some solutions, things like telemedicine, telehealth, where regional hospitals could be more helpful to our smaller communities, and doctors and physicians and nurses could be accessible through the internet and through utilizing some of that technology that we've all been looking forward to having in all of our rural communities. And that kind of raises another question just about how accessible and how much connectivity do we have in our rural communities? Do we have broadband internet capabilities in all of our rural areas? And the answer to that is no. So I think that's going to be another number one priority for us to consider as we move forward. And it doesn't just affect the healthcare sector. It affects education. It affects the workforce. It affects agricultural communities as well, farming and ranching, when they don't have access to current data involving as far as like prices of cotton, prices of livestock, they need the access as well. So COVID-19 has kind of, I think, accelerated our awareness of these issues that we already knew were pending and were problems that we needed to address. But I think COVID-19 has exacerbated and even caused us to realize we can't wait any longer. We have got to address these issues as far as telehealth, telemedicine, and broadband.
In your first term, you served on the Energy Resources Committee. And as you mentioned, the oil and gas industry has taken quite a hit this year. What specific steps do you think the state legislature should be doing to support the industry?
I think things that we've already started doing are reducing some of the regulations necessary for our oil and gas industry to be able to recover and to continue to be a major exporter of oil and gas. As you know, Texas was the 10th largest economy prior to COVID-19. I don't know anything necessarily, or I haven't seen anything that changes that particular rating or ranking, you might say. But I do think our oil and gas industry will continue to operate. I know that talking to producers and other service type industries and such that cater and work in the oil and gas industry, that there actually is still quite a bit of activity going on. Some of that is because of lease requirements for consistent drilling. If some of the oil companies don't continue drilling, then they lose those lease rights. And so there's going to be kind of a certain level, you might say a minimum level of activity that's going to continue to go on. Obviously, we can't control what the price of oil is. That has a lot to do with demand and supply. So as other countries rebound from COVID-19, as the United States rebounds from COVID-19, I think you'll see our oil and gas industry continue to recover fairly quickly. I think Texas continues to be a very strong participant in the world economy as far as the demand for oil and gas. So I think nothing should change there once we kind of get through this pandemic. So I think that from the state legislator standpoint, continuing to be a strong advocate for the petrochemical industry and just making sure that we have all of the tools available to them, which in my estimation, in my opinion, is really reducing regulations. And we've been successful at that in the last several years, and Governor Abbott fully supports that.
One of the other big news stories this year has been the tension between communities demanding change in law enforcement to prevent further deaths of people in police custody or those who are being detained. And some have called for specific changes to training or holds. Other communities are calling for cuts to police department funding. In Texas, a lot of people are focusing their calls on shifting some funds to mental health or housing, which is something decided more at the local level. Now, Governor Abbott wants the legislature to pass legislation that would penalize cities that slash police funding. Are you on board with that? And how would you address concerns of the community about excessive and sometimes deadly force?
Well, I think we've all watched the videos and we've seen the situation involving George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and other situations around our country that we just, we send our thoughts and prayers to those families. Obviously, those are what I consider really extreme examples of some bad apples that occur. You know, there are bad apples in every industry. I think that we need to make sure that we understand that law enforcement is a very tough job. Our police forces carry out a tremendous mission whenever they go out into our communities and provide us the safety and protection that we have become accustomed to. And so I realize that we need to reform some things that need to be reformed, and we certainly need more training, and I will continue to support that. I don't think cutting resources is necessarily the answer that we should jump to those conclusions right away. I do think that we should have those kind of open, honest discussions. This is, again, kind of an area where I feel differently as far as the state making huge, massive reforms or passing major pieces of legislation, because, again, I don't think what's going on in West Texas is the same as what's going on in Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and Austin. So I would be somewhat reluctant to be supportive of any massive legislation. But I think those changes and those policies need to be addressed locally. I think just for an example, I think in the city of Abilene, I think we're having those kinds of discussions and those kinds of talks. I think our local police department has already started making some changes in terms of the training and the reforms that we're talking about. So, yes, we need to address these issues, and we need to have those discussions and that dialogue. I haven't really spoken to the governor or his staff to talk about what he is proposing as far as maybe, I guess it was the city of Austin that he was responding to in terms of some cuts in their budget for police funding. So I don't really know the details there to really be able to make comment. But again, overall, do we need reform? Do we need more training? Absolutely. Does it need to be done in massive sweeping changes at the state level? I don't support that. I think it needs to be looked at a local level with local and civic involvement from all the stakeholders, all the people that would be affected. And that's a large group. And I understand that trying to get large groups together is somewhat difficult during a pandemic. But at the same time, I think that we can make strides towards ensuring that something like what happened to George Floyd or to Breonna Taylor does not occur in our communities. And so, yes, I'm supportive of reform. Yes, I'm supportive of additional training. But I would like to see most of that discussion occurring at the local level.
2020 has been a really hard year in so many ways. I'm wondering where you see areas for hope as you look ahead to 2021 and the next legislative session.
Well, I have hope because I think we've been very responsible to the 30 million Texans that live in Texas, that we have always been conservative in terms of our fiscal approach, that we've always been prudent and fiscally conservative in how we establish the spending priorities for our state. And really, if you want to know what a state is, you know, what it really believes in, what its policies are, what it looks forward to in terms of outlining a vision for the future, it's like any other organization, any other government, city, school board, anything. You look at the budget, you look and see where the money is being spent. And so I think as we look ahead, we still have a major commitment to education in Texas. We'll continue to be that advocate. We'll continue to be that supporter of making sure that our children and our students have all the opportunities to be successful, no matter whether they live in inner city Houston or whether they live in the dry desert areas of West Texas. Those opportunities are going to still be available to every student and every child that enters into our public education system. Healthcare is another area, obviously, that's been heightened, the awareness of where we have some deficiencies, where we have the uninsured population needs to be addressed in some form or format. You know, we've always kind of been in either all or nothing in terms of Medicaid expansion. I'm open to having a dialogue and a discussion about where we can fill some gaps and make Medicaid more accessible to those that are most vulnerable, our children and certainly our senior citizens. So I do think those are some opportunities that although most people would look at 2020 and say COVID-19, this was a disaster year in many respects. We've got a lot of people suffering and a lot of people hurting, whether they run a small business and haven't been able to reopen yet, or whether they've had to lay off employees, and whether you're one of those employees that got laid off, and whether your health care was in danger of being removed or not accessible to you. We've got a lot of things that we can certainly address moving forward. But I see those as opportunities. Yes, there are going to be challenges in a tough budget session, but at the same time, I think we can try to bridge the gap and make sure that we address those needs in a very proper and a very fiscally prudent, without raising taxes, without asking the taxpayers of Texas to increase their burden or their share. That's one thing about public education and the funding that we did with House Bill 3. We increased the state's share of overall funding from 38% to 45%. none of us are very satisfied with that. We want it to be up closer to 50% of the total funding that's available for education or public education. The state needs to be paying half of that share. We've relied too much on local taxpayers to shoulder that burden. So I think we're on the right track. We may have to kind of step back during a tough budget session with less revenue and try to make sure that we don't hemorrhage certain programs and certain services, but that we can stop the bleeding and make sure that we take care of those citizens that are in most need and make sure that our children and our schools are in good position to move forward. The state's still growing, and I think that's the good news. The optimism that our state is still looked at as one of the top states to relocate. We're hearing some really good news coming from the governor's office about possible business relocations. The companies that are located in some of these major cities in the United States that feel like maybe the protection and the safety of their citizens and their employees is not up to speed as it should be. They're actually looking at Texas as a possible place to relocate. So that means more economy, more economic development. That means more jobs, better paying jobs, more stability, more tax revenue. When people are working, that obviously that they're buying goods and services, and those sales taxes come back into our state government as well as our local governments. And so, as I've said before, a rising tide lifts all boats. And the most important thing, other than taking care of our citizens and making sure that they're safe and they're protected, is that we get this economy rolling again and we get Texas again being that leader in terms of relocation.
Well, we've spent a lot of time talking about the next legislative session and looking ahead, but I did want to take a minute to look back to 2019. Your name was on the list, the infamous list, that House Speaker Dennis Bonin had come up with, names of state legislators that he wanted to target to push out. I know you were disappointed to be on that list, but have you figured out why he added your name? How did you get crosswise with the speaker?
Well, actually, Heather, I was very glad to be on the list. And the reason I was glad to be on the list is because when I looked at the other names of the members that were on that list, those are people I have tremendous respect for. I admire and I look up to them. They've been mentors to me. And realistically, there could have been another 25 or 30 names on that list. You know, why 10 of us were selected and why 10 of us were targeted, I really believe it's an affirmation of the fact that the Speaker of the House knew that he couldn't control my vote. And when I go to Austin and I represent the citizens and the constituents in House District 71, my first and number one priority is to represent 165,000 people that live in Taylor Jones and Nolan County. And when the Speaker of the House knows that he can't control my vote, to me that is an affirmation that I'm doing the job that I was elected to go do. So I'm actually very proud to be on that list, Heather. And I feel like it's kind of a badge of honor, and it reaffirms again what I said as far as representing my district, and my vote is not for sale. And so if the Speaker of the House wanted to replace me with someone that was more in line with what he believes or what the policies that he wanted to get approved and legislation he wanted passed, then I feel like I'm doing my job and I'm doing the best of my ability in representing the constituents and people that live and work and go to church in House District 71. So contrary to your thought, I was very proud to be on that list.
Well, I'm curious of what the reaction has been among your colleagues. Have you gotten different type of, I guess, have you had a different type of relationship with people after that spotlight was shown on you?
No doubt. I mean, I think that the members of the House who supported our speaker I've had very little communication with those members. But again, there are probably 35 or 40 to really probably closer to 50 members who reached out to me, who empathized, who said they didn't understand why my name was on the list. They thought I was a good member, that I was doing a good job for my district. I voted the way I felt like my district wanted me to vote. And so, yeah, it's been a little bit of a mixed bag as far as the reaction from other members that come from my party. But I just feel like going forward, we'll work through those issues and we'll come to an agreement that we're still representing the majority of the state in terms of our fiscal prudence, our conservativeness of leading this state. And I think that hopefully on November 3rd, the majority of Texas will agree with us and reelect us to the House majority.
Well, I wanted to just ask if there was anything else you wanted to get to that I didn't ask you about to this point.
Well, I just I want people to know that it's always a challenge to try to represent your district. I know that there are always opposing voices to the way maybe my voting record has been, to the way we try to represent the constituents in Texas, and particularly in House District 71. So we listen. We're accessible. My office and my staff, when people call in, we don't ask if you're a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian. We take your call. And if you've got a problem, if you're dealing with a state agency and you need help, we jump in and we try to help you as best we can. So we try to run a nonpartisan office, even though I'm elected as in one of those parties, but we try to represent all 165,000 people in House District 71. So I would just say that we will continue to be good listeners. We will try to understand what problems people are experiencing with state government, with certain agencies, whether it's getting a driver's license renewed or whether it's having a problem filing a claim for unemployment insurance benefits. Whatever the issue is, we're going to go to bat. We're going to work hard for those constituents. But we have to know if you're having a problem, so you have to kind of reach out to us and let us know. Certainly we have phone numbers and email addresses on our website that you can access. And again, we will return your call and we'll try to do the very best job we can for you. So again, we represent all 165,000 constituents, and we want to go to bat for you and try to help you as much as we can navigate this complex and sometimes difficult bureaucracy we call state government.
Representative Lambert, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Heather. It's been good being with you.
Representative Stan Lambert is running for a third term to the Texas State House, representing Taylor, Nolan, and Jones counties. He faces a challenge from Democrat Sam Hatton. You can hear our conversation with Hatton and find more information on both candidates on our website, kacu.org. Coming up next in our series of election interviews, we'll hear from the candidates for State Senate District 24. Up first, Clayton Tucker, who's challenging State Senator Don Buckingham. I'm Heather Claiborne. This is KACU.